Greetings and salutations to the far middle army of constant listeners. And I use the term army because it's time to give a shout out to what has become a far middle tradition in mid to late May, which is a tip of the hat to all the active duty military personnel in the USA for Armed Forces Day. Over a million Americans currently serve in the armed forces. Armed Forces Day is the opportunity to formally recognize them, and it was this past weekend. And the push for such a day started back during the Truman administration. Great idea and a worthy day of honor, to say the least. Interesting episode planned for you today, a deep dive on a topic. And we're going to kick it off with a funny and unique sports dedication. But let me start by backing up a bit. So sports, they're full of physical confrontation. That's to be expected when you combine the drive to win, world-class athletes, and intense heat-of-the-moment collisions of both wills and bodies. Think of boxing. Its entire premise is built on physical confrontation. Football. You know, football isn't too far from boxing with its intended collisions. Hockey, you know, it's been known to see the dropping of the gloves in fistfights from time to time. As much a part of the game as slap shots, it seems. Basketball can be quite physical. I think of the Jordan rules and what number 23 had to go through to climb the mountain to an NBA title. The Pistons in Detroit alone treated Jordan to what on the street would be clear-cut felonious assault. But not so much for physical aspects when you think of the sport of baseball, right? Heck, most brawls, so to speak, in baseball, they're nothing more than some pushing and standing around. Maybe a punch here or there will be thrown, but those are rare. However, we have a dedication this week that is the exception. A base brawl, so to speak, that was one for the ages. It occurred back in 1984, and the brawl encompassed basically the entire game. There was so much going on, and to fully appreciate it, you need to listen to this dedication, and then after this episode of The Far Middle, go to YouTube, type in Padres Braves Fight 1984. So Padres Braves Fight 1984. Then watch what I'm about to describe. It is pure entertainment, and I'm happy to say nobody was injured. There were a few arrests of fans, a few ejections of players, some fines and suspensions as well for both teams, but no hospital visits. So let's walk through this train wreck of a baseball game frame by frame. This game is often tagged as the Bean Brawl game, and the Padres were playing at the Braves. This is coming up on 40 years ago now, in August of 1984. The teams had legends and well-known players of the era on the roster of both. So the Braves, their manager was Joe Torre. Their outfield had a guy in it named Dale Murphy, who made it to the Hall of Fame. The Padres, they had Tony Gwynn, Goose Gossage, and Steve Garvey on their team. But the individuals who played the most prominent roles in this meltdown, they weren't the big-name stars, as we will see. Much of the cause of the brawl that day, the fourth and final game of the set, was due to what occurred prior between the two teams in the four-game set. Allen Wiggins was a player for the Padres who was a leadoff hitter. He kept bunting to get on base in games prior in that series, and that was making the Braves irate. So on the fateful day of the brawl, the Braves pitcher, Pascual Perez, he beamed Allen Wiggins. He hit him with the ball when he pitched it to him, the leadoff hitter, on the very first pitch of the game. Well, that created the need to retaliate as far as the Padres were concerned. So the Padres decided to throw at the guy who hit Wiggins, the pitcher Perez. But unbelievably, the Padres pitchers couldn't hit the guy. He kept jumping around and avoiding being hit by the ball. And the Padre pitchers tried four times to hit Perez, four different at-bats, didn't succeed until the last at-bat. You can believe that. Now, one of the nuttiest sequences of that crazy game, and there were a lot of them, was the first time the Padres tried to hit Perez and ended up throwing the baseball behind him. So Perez was a little bit jumpy. He knew what was coming and he was ready to fight. So when the ball was thrown behind him, the Padres catcher tried to retrieve it, but Perez thought that the catcher was going to try to attack him from behind. So Perez starts dancing around like Muhammad Ali, and he's sort of wielding his bat menacingly, sort of waving it menacingly at the different players. And that results in a scrum of players and benches being cleared, but no major fighting at that point. Now, the next time or times the Padres try to hit Perez when he's up to bat, they keep missing him and the umpire ejects the pitcher and the Padres manager, a 1970s and 80s baseball legend, Dick Williams. And the third at bat for Perez also results in the Padres trying to hit him but failing. and having yet another pitcher ejected. But a Padres pitcher finally succeeded in hitting Perez in the eighth inning, which led to the day's biggest fight, as the umpire is ejecting yet another Padres pitcher and the backup manager. The Braves storm the field from the dugout, and the main event is on. Now, everyone is in on the melee, including the umpire, Big John McSherry. Some of you baseball fans may remember him. He's a big guy, and he got knocked over in the pileup and sort of got stuck down there. Things then got even crazier. There was a player for the Padres by the name of Champ Summers, and he got a late start to his pro career, having served in Vietnam. He then joined a softball team after his service and then was signed by a Major League Baseball team when they saw him at the softball game. That's a crazy career path for a baseball player. Now, Champ was built like a brick you-know-what, and in the scrum, he figures out that the Braves pitcher, Perez, who was sort of the center of all this attention, he isn't even in the mix. He sort of is off into the dugout without a care in the world. He just escaped the whole thing. So Champ Summers decides to leave the brawl on the field and charge after Perez in the Braves dugout. There's only one problem for Champ, and his name is Bob Horner. Now, Horner was built like an even bigger brick you-know-what than Summers. And Horner wasn't playing that day because of a broken hand that was in a cast. He wasn't even in uniform, but he knew trouble was brewing, so he suited up in his uniform and came out of the Braves clubhouse when he saw the fight between the teams, and he blocks Champ Summers from getting to Perez. And when Bob Horner blocks you, you stop, even if you're Champ Summers. Well, Champ stops, and all this happens right next to the stands. And at that moment, all hell breaks loose. One fan throws beer or some other drink on Summers. Then another Atlanta fan jumps the railing and jumps onto Summers' back and pulls him down. And then another fan, who's wearing these bright yellow pants, it's an outfit right out of Caddyshack that you'll see if you watch the video, he dives over the railing, and then all the Padres and Braves arrive and jump into the melee. Arrests were made right there. But it still wasn't over. Far from it. Fast forward to the top of the ninth. Craig Nettles. Now, he was a 70s and 80s fixture at third base and wasn't ever shy about fighting when he had to. He punched a Brave pitcher during the first scrap, who ended up pitching in the ninth. Now, you know it's going to happen next. So this pitcher who got punched by Nettles, he's the pitcher on the mound in the ninth, and he's facing Nettles. Of course, the pitcher hits Nettles. Nettles charges the mound. Massive brawl once again. And this is the third one for the game. And in this one, Joe Torre, the manager for the Braves, he's rolling around on the ground. Then the Atlanta fans, they start throwing stuff into the Padres dugout. There's a pitcher for the Padres. His name's Ed Whitson. He's shirtless, I guess, because he already got thrown out of the game earlier. And he's already ejected from the game. So he starts to scream and shaking his fist and pointing a bat at the fans from the dugout. Another fan runs on the field, and the Braves players actually tackle him. Ed Whitson, the shirtless one, he sees this, and he has to be subdued by his teammates in the Padres dugout to stop him with his bat from running out to attack the fan. Now, after it was all over, 17 players ejected, 4 managers and coaches ejected, numerous fans arrested. How did the game end? The umpires told the teams in the ninth inning to go to their clubhouses and only send players out who would be fielding or who were up to bat. That's how they ended the game. John McSherry, that umpire that I told you about, he said afterward the game was the worst thing I've ever seen in my life, and it had set baseball back 50 years. Perhaps, but the drama led to an incredibly epic confrontation of entertainment 40 years later, at least. Now, we spent a little more time than typical for this dedication, but it was worth it. Heed my advice, head to YouTube to watch the videos of the Padres-Braves brawl from 1984. I provided a link for you on the podcast summary that you can see, an entertaining drama for everyone, whether it's the non-sports fan, someone with passing interest in baseball, to the diehard aficionado. Yeah, sports dedication, it's more pure drama and entertainment than sport, I suppose. The dedication serves as a useful launch point for our connections and primary theme this episode. Let me start this way. What if that blow-by-blow summary that I provided of the meltdown between the Braves and the Padres from 1984, what if my summary was delivered exclusively from the perspective of a devout Braves fan? Or how would it differ and contrast if I delivered a summary of those events from a purely partisan Padres fan perspective. Both versions would be quite different than the objective, factual truth summary in the Padres fan versus Braves fan versions. They would paint two entirely different pictures as to what transpired and who was to blame. Now, when it comes to issues and events that are much more important than a baseball game, Western Republican democracies have relied for centuries on a free press and on objective journalism to provide balanced views of issues of the day. Unfortunately, that is no longer the case. And some of the most established and renowned names in news and journalism, they've morphed into more of a biased, rabid fan view of reporting and journalism versus objective and balanced. And there are two prime examples we'll discuss today, the New York Times and NPR, or National Public Radio. Let's start with the New York Times. That's the gold standard of news, right? With over 10 million paying customers. But the institution is partisan and it leans heavily toward the ideological left. And that's frankly been the history of the New York Times for almost 100 years, not just a recent development. So consider the history. That's a helpful and I think insightful walk. In the 1930s, there was a reporter who covered Russia for the New York Times who became a celebrity and achieved journalistic superstar status. His name was Walter Duranty. And he helped cover up the communist-induced famine of the Ukraine, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for it along the way. Now, in private conversations, the reporter confirmed that he knew about the famine despite not reporting on it, and he admitted to a State Department official that it was effectively New York Times policy to have his reports reflect the official opinion of the Soviet regime and not his own. The New York Times hired a third party to assess whether the Pulitzer Prize that was awarded, whether it should have been returned because of this biased reporting. And the third party, they recommended that the Times should return the prize. But New York Times never returned it. Then there was a New York Times view of Mao Zedong, the brutal dictator of communist China, whose policies led to the deaths of what, almost 100 million people, a real sweetheart. The New York Times once described Mao as a democratic agrarian reformer. Now, it's funny, when I look up synonyms for mass murderer, I don't come up with the democratic agrarian reformer as an option. Then there was how the New York Times just adored Fidel Castro, the Cuban dictator. The paper polished his image and called him democratic. The paper's publisher met with Castro when he was rising to power. And then in the mid-90s, Castro visited the paper's headquarters in New York. He did it again in 2000. A former editor of the paper who witnessed one of those visits said that Castro was welcomed at the offices by an excited crowd of staffers who followed him around like the guy was Michael Jackson or Elvis. And in 2001, the New York Times publisher took a team of writers and editors to Beijing, sort of a field trip. And on that field trip, the paper managed to convince the Chinese Communist Party to unlock the New York Times website in China. Now, I don't know what the specifics were or what discussions or negotiations entailed, can't say for sure. But we do know that after those meetings, the paper published a positive and flattering piece on the then leader of the Chinese Communist Party. And before you knew it, guess what? The New York Times website in China was unblocked. An amazing coincidence. In 1897, the then owner of the New York Times created the famous slogan, "All the news that's fit to print," which still appears, by the way, on the masthead of the paper. The author and thinker Christopher Hitchens, who I've always enjoyed reading and listening to, he once came up with an awesome quote about the New York Times motto. He said, "I myself check every day to make sure that that bright, smug, pompous, idiotic claim is still there." Love the work of Hitchens. Now, what he was pointing out with his quote about the motto of "all the news that's fit to print" is that the paper and its staff, they get to subjectively decide what is fit and what is unfit to print. Some might call that censorship or bias. But now the New York Times is facing an even more complicated quandary, because within the staff, there is great debate and friction over what the news should be and what news should be published. Should the paper publish stories with the slanting of an advocate with a favorite view or ideology reflected in a story? Or should it be objective and sticking to the facts straight down the middle? The newsroom is in a brawl mode over such questions at the Gray Lady, as the New York Times is known, especially over the really hot topics and emotional issues, like, for example, the Israeli and Hamas war that's going on in Gaza. management is fighting with different factions, some of them leftist in nature, of the journalist staff. And there's an internal probe underway to assess how members of the Times may have leaked information regarding pending stories to outside third parties to try to disrupt those news stories from being published. Sort of a civil war that is afoot within the New York Times. Leadership in the newsroom is worried that certain journalists for the paper, they're surrendering a duty of neutrality when reporting and replacing it with ideological leanings and filters when they perform their job, because that would be the news that is, again, quote, fit to print from the left-leaning journalist's perspective. The facts be damned. The publisher worries that the trust of readers is at risk. And the publisher should be worried, because if impartiality is compromised, it's going to lead to what the publisher calls a different model of journalism, one guided by personal perspective and animated by personal conviction. Now, I agree with the assessment of the publisher, but I do take exception to the individual labeling such a problem as a different model of journalism. That's not journalism. That's advocacy or propaganda. Others who track objectivity and trustworthiness and credibility in news are taking note of what's going on at the New York Times. NewsGuard is an organization that ranks and rates credibility of news sites. And earlier this year, NewsGuard reduced the New York Times score from a maximum of 100 down to the upper 80s because the firm believes the paper didn't have a clear enough delineation between news and opinion. The crisis at the New York Times has been brewing for some time. Now, it went from objective journalism to left-leaning to outright civil war when the stringent ideologues of the staff were no longer content with even center-left reporting, which takes us to a connection of Barry Weiss. She was an op-ed staff editor and writer on culture and politics at the New York Times until she resigned from the Times in 2020. Why? According to her, for criticizing the Times for capitulating to leftist criticism and for the Times not defending her against alleged bullying by her colleagues. Now, she's been busy since the 2020 New York Times resignation, founding a media company, The Free Press, which is a interesting news source. I encourage you to check that out online. And she is a fellow Pittsburgh native, by God. Now, Weiss serves as a connection to our second deep dive on the credibility crisis in journalism. And that is what is going on at National Public Radio, or NPR. There was an essay published on Barry Weiss's new media outlet, The Free Press, back in early April from a veteran at NPR. And for those of you who don't know, NPR is that legendary and government-funded, I'll point out, radio program that had millions of Americans as loyal listeners through the years, including your host. It's a legend of radio and media. So a veteran NPR staffer, Yuri Berliner, he pens a lengthy expose on the Free Press site that took NPR to task when it came to its ideological bias when reporting supposed news. And I encourage you to give the Berliner a read at the Free Press site, his essay, but I can provide you a summary here. It directly connects to the theme of this episode. Berliner points out that although NPR has traditionally held somewhat liberal leanings or a bit of a liberal bent, most of his tenure at NPR encompassed significant open-mindedness when developing stories and reporting news. It was a culture that was more inquisitive than ideological. But today, he argues that NPR is something quite different when it comes to its culture. He defined it as reflecting the distilled worldview of a very small segment of the U.S. population. Berliner points out how the ideological demographics of NPR's audience, they've changed quite a bit over the years. Back in 2011, not that long ago, over a quarter of NPR listeners described themselves as conservative, about a quarter as middle of the road, and about 37% as liberal. That's not a bad mix or balance. But by 2023, only 11% of NPR listeners described themselves as very or somewhat conservative, just over 20% middle of the road, and then 67% of listeners said they were very or somewhat liberal. His point, of course, was that NPR has certainly lost conservative, but also middle-of-the-road or moderate listeners. And he suggests that the reason is that the reporting and the content of NPR productions have a strong leftist and biased approach. And he provides a few examples of big NPR and national stories over the past few years that apply such a slant and bias. The first example is the alleged and now disproven conspiracy theory that the Trump campaign colluded with Russia over the 2016 election. Now, NPR desperately wanted the story or conspiracy theory to be true, to the point where it focused just about all of its interviews and reporting exclusively on the conspiracy theorists. Berliner said that NPR hosts, they interviewed Adam Schiff, who was the lead congressional attack dog in the Trump-Russia election conspiracy theory, 25 times about the topic. And when the Mueller report came out and it found that there was no credible evidence of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, NPR's coverage was, as Berliner put it, sparse. The whole Russiagate conspiracy theory just slowly faded away from NPR content. No apology, no we got it wrong, no mea culpa, and no self-reflection with respect to what went wrong or what the root causes of the problem were. NPR simply pretended it never happened, prompting a conspiracy theory in terms of promoting it that proved to be, in the end, a bit of a laughable falsehood. The second example of the NPR leftist and ideological bias presented by Berliner was the laptop that everyone ended up talking about, the Hunter Biden laptop. The New York Post in 2020 reports about Hunter's laptop and what might be on it. The election was looming, and NPR decided to turn a blind eye. NPR, according to Berliner, saw the laptop story as a waste of time. It wasn't a real story, and it was just nothing more than a distraction. Berliner wrote in his essay that a journalist at NPR with an excellent reputation justified not following and not reporting on the Hunter laptop story because it could potentially help Trump. Third example that Berliner offers up deals with COVID and pandemic. And one of our favorite celebrities that we once had a feature on with the Far Middle, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Now, remember our Fauci focus segment? Well, maybe this will serve as a swan song. Yeah, when it came to COVID origins, NPR played into the elite and leftist view that it could not have come from a Chinese lab. It must have come from some animal market or such thing in Wuhan. NPR dismissed the lab leak theory as right-wing conspiracy stuff, and even at times as being racist, basically backed up 100% the positions that Anthony Fauci and the NIH took. Berliner points out that when the Department of Energy, which by the way is the federal agency with the most expertise about biological research in labs, when the DOE concluded that a lab leak was the most likely explanation for the emergence of COVID, NPR still didn't change its position defending the natural origin of COVID and ridiculing the lab leak view of COVID. Now, after you assess Berliner's three examples of how NPR is unable to objectively report news in an unbiased manner, you understand his position that there's an unspoken consensus, I think that was the term that he used, about the types of stories that should be pursued by NPR. He referenced it as being akin to an assembly line, manufacturing a view, theme, and what to think. All of it taxpayer-funded, meaning NPR is essentially a government entity. Now, that assembly line, as he referenced it, is destroying NPR. NPR, early in 2024, was celebrating that it earned a higher trustworthy score than CNN or the New York Times in a Harris poll. And that sounds great, but there's a problem. That beating CNN and New York Times, it only required, apparently, a 3-10 score on the poll that said they associated NPR with being trustworthy. Berliner points out, and I agree, that you shouldn't be doing victory laps in a news organization when it comes to trustworthiness, when only 3-10 Americans feel that you are trustworthy. And what's that say about the New York Times? Yikes. Now, in mid-April, Berliner was suspended for 5 days without pay because of, I guess, this essay. And then a few days later, Yuri Berliner resigned from NPR. He had a statement. He said, "I am resigning from NPR, a great American institution where I've worked for 25 years. I don't support calls to defund NPR. I respect the integrity of my colleagues and wish for NPR to thrive and do important journalism, but I cannot work in a newsroom where I am disparaged by a new CEO whose divisive views confirm the very problems at NPR I cited in my free press essay." Okay, let's hope NPR finds its way back toward where it once was, that balanced and inquisitive, trusted news source. And even though we're hoping for the future of NPR that it turns out positive, I do have my concerns. A lot of that centers around the current leader, the CEO of NPR, who has some interesting views on things that are crucial for a news organization. One is her view on the First Amendment at times being what she references as a challenge. That gives me a concern. Another view is that she once said that a reverence for the truth could at times be a distraction. Now I'm really concerned. But again, let's hope for the best when it comes to NPR and that once proud organization. Hey, that about does it for episode 157. Let's end the episode in the same year we started it with our base brawl, 1984. The top five Nielsen ratings for TV shows back in 1984. It has and serves as a connection that we can end on. So the top shows were Dynasty at number one, Dallas at number two, The Cosby Show at number three, and 60 Minutes at number four. Now, one of those was a news show, and it still runs fresh episodes to this day. But can an objective observer conclude that the 60 Minutes of today is a balanced presentation of issues? Or has it become something more akin to the Dynasties and the Dallases? So to borrow that phrase from the New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, see you next week when we will have a new episode with all the connections fit to discuss.